The Bible study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Good morning. This is Hour 2 of the Bible Study. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour right here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thank you for joining us this morning. You know, if you've been watching the news, there are a number of headlines out there that talk about the relationship between church and state. Even the Lutheran Witness, the news magazine of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, has talked about the two kingdoms, the proper relation between those two. I mean, we played some audio yesterday about a bishop who's under fire because he made a comparison to President Obama, and oh my goodness, I think children's greatest desire is to be taught. To be taught by someone who really knows their stuff when it comes to not just theology, but the world, how the two kingdoms, the left and the right, relate to each other. What do you think this music represents? Only one thing. Our very good friend, the Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan, is back for his turn at the microphone during the Ask the Pastor program here. How are you, my friend? Good morning.
Fine. Doing great. Thank you.
Oh, I tell you, adults and children like are dancing across St. Louis right now and all across the world as they hear that music. You just can't help it. Just got that nice kind of a catchy tune to it. Hey, how are you, my friend? Everything going well in Indiana?
Yeah, we're getting more of the cold weather after the hot weather, after the cold. Who knows? This is really, really strange weather out here. I'm sure it's the same in St. Louis.
Well, yeah, it's kind of up and down and back and forth and around and around. Yeah, it's kind of like reading John.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned that there's a couple of stories in the news about the relationship between church and state, and since you have been so good in the past, you've written about these things and had some other commentary about them, that I thought I'd run some stuff by you today, and maybe you can bring some clarity to how we, as Christians, Lutheran Christians and others, are supposed to relate to the state, and how the state in, you know, the perfect world really should be relating to us. There's the bishop I started to mention who's up in Peoria, who, when he looked at how President Obama is conducting the business of state, made a comparison to Hitler and Stalin as sort of the totalitarian approach, like the HHS mandate that contraception must be provided by church bodies and organizations that are run by church bodies. There's a Catholic school teacher who underwent an IVF process, the in vitro fertilization, and when you know, she was working at this Catholic school. When they found out about it, they fired her. This has now become a federal case that refers back to very important SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States ruling just recently about a Lutheran school, the Hosanna Tabor School, and who is and is not a minister. And even now there's yet another headline about abortion and birth control. Will the church be forced to choose? It's no longer going to be, you know, abstaining from the process. The government's, in this one article, says the government's going to come along and say, you're going to have to pick. You're going to have to do one of the two. You can't opt out any longer. So when you look at all these stories and you look at the presidential year, what's your take, Marty, on the tone of the whole theological political debate in this season?
Well, first off, it is a presidential year, and that that tends to amplify things. People do and say things that they wouldn't, I think, in normal circumstances. Because what I think they hope that what they do or say is going to help their political cause, you know, to get somebody they know or that they root for to get elected, and then after that's over, well, then they just go back to the normal thing. So there is a lot of hype, and you got to realize that. And people that maybe are for the first time in their life kind of aware of how politics works in the country, or how it doesn't work sometimes. That can be disconcerting unless you've been through this a number of cycles and you've seen it before and say, well, that's what it is. What's new this time, and that's, I think, why we're interested in this topic, is how religion has got mixed into this. And the question is this a new thing or an old thing, or in what sense is it new?
Well, you know, there's that old saying about it. Opinions are like elbows. Everybody has at least two of them. But are they informed opinions today? As you sort of survey the way people react to these stories, whether inside or outside of the church, do you think we as a people possess the credibility to judge anything anymore?
No. That's a really good question. In fact, educators are talking about this a lot, and there is a great concern. And I'm late middle age now, so I remember having good conversations with both of my grandparents, who were born. All of them were born about 1900 or shortly before.
Yeah, so were mine. Yeah,
and none of them went to college. I think none of my, maybe one grandparent, I think he graduated from high school, but I'm not sure. The other one went to work at age 11, and the grandmothers, I don't know if they graduated from high school either. So they didn't have what we would consider, like, necessary education today. But when it came to understanding the U.S. government and politics and how it works, they were very, very knowledgeable, and much more than anybody that I can talk to as a certainly a high school graduate today. I mean, there are some exceptions, kids that really get into this and they dig into it. But overall, the simply the knowledge of basics of U.S. government, how it works, are the basic historical issues, why this country was founded, some of the background on that. And not even to talk to the issue of church and state, which is a complex topic. Young people today, and I include even my generation, were a lot farther behind our grandparents on this. And that, I think, is part of the problem. If you have a vast majority, let's say 80% of the people, that don't know the basics of how the government works and what it's supposed to do, then it's all just opinion. It's not, and so what would my grandparents and their brothers and sisters and their friends, when they would get together, I remember this would happen, like, say, at Easter or Thanksgiving when the whole family was together. And after they'd had the turkey and they were sitting, the men were smoking in the living room and the ladies were cleaning up and talking in the kitchen, they would be talking about politics. And I would just sit and listen. I wouldn't go out with the kids. I would listen to what they were saying. And they would hold very intelligent discussions. And then when I went through U.S. government in high school, I said, well, they knew what they were talking about. And these were mostly people that maybe graduated from high school or maybe didn't. And so then if they had an opinion but knew that it was contrary to fact, they just didn't express it because they know everybody thought they were stupid. But nowadays, because people don't know the basic facts about how government works or our heritage and all these issues, they express their opinion and expect everybody to bow down before it. And I think that's where things have changed.
Can you apply those same comments to the church?
Yeah, I think it also applies in the church, too. I would say in terms of basic catechesis, the same thing. On my mother's side of the family, they were all Missouri Synod Lutherans. My dad's was not. But when they got together, they would also talk about the church. And none of them went to Concordia High Schools. I think most of them, maybe half of them, went to a Lutheran grade school. And they had a confirmation class at eighth grade. And that was probably it in terms of formal education. But when they got together, they would talk about theology and church and do so in a very intelligent way. And I can't say that young adults or even middle-aged adults can do that today either. So that, now, I don't think that people are less intelligent today. What it is that the scope of what they're interested in or what they're required to learn, it's become so much bigger that issues of U.S. government, U.S. history, church theology, issues that confront the church, they're just like put down in the 5%, where it used to be that was more like 50 to 60%, and so there was just a lot of ignorance. And then it, you know, when you talk about issues of governance or politics or the church, they're very emotional issues because they affect all of us. And this is why previous generations said everybody getting out of high school better know a whole lot so they don't issue forth opinions that are just really dumb. And the thing is, you know, between the entertainment that's out there, the distractions and sports and everything else, that all gets pushed aside. Kids don't think it's interesting. They don't pay attention. And then what you result in is adults that just, they're just ignorant. And so I think maybe a political season like this, that everybody's shooting off their mouth and it doesn't, you can't make heads or tails, maybe it should tell people, maybe I need to get back and to learn some of the basics on this.
Yeah. So you've keyed in on a very important word, I think, Marty, and that is the word ignorant. I think people, when they first hear that, take that as a pejorative. You're calling somebody a name. But you're talking about a condition of being where you just don't know anything.
Right. It's not a matter of intelligence. It's a matter of an area of knowledge that really, I mean, politics and religion are very important for people. And if they neglect it, it's going to come and bite them. And I won't tell them where to bite them, but it will bite them.
Somewhere unpleasant. One of the arguments that I've heard since I was a kid, you know, the line goes something to the effect of, you don't talk about religion and politics in polite company. It almost as if, as creatures, we were created able to compartmentalize one issue from another, that we can hold perhaps a Lutheran Christian worldview, but that really shouldn't come into play with our politics, and it shouldn't come into play with other things as well, like maybe even economics. But are we built that way? Can we compartmentalize these things? And if not, how should our theology influence our politics and vice versa?
Well, I think the first thing that, because you're talking about, you know, talking with people, whether face to face or let's say through the radio, like we're doing now, the first thing you have to do is to respect other people, and to respect others' positions and opinions, even if they are kind of weird. There are certainly positions that are just completely eccentric, that they're idiosyncratic to one individual. You don't necessarily have to give that a lot of respect. But any person that's giving a political or religious position that is held by a large number of people, let's say by a church body, denomination, by another religion, or by another political group, you need to give that person respect. There are reasons. There are rational reasons why they hold these positions. And one thing that I'm disappointed with in the media in particular is how they have given less respect to the Christian world, or for that matter the Jewish or any religious worldview. And that's become more and more so. And that's really disappointing because, I mean, the majority of the people in the United States are religious in some respect. You know, maybe not everybody goes to church every Sunday. We know that. But they do have strongly held religious positions, even if they don't go to church every Sunday. And to hear the media regularly demean this, these people, the people that are in charge of media are out of touch. And I lived in New York City for 4 years, and I can tell you that the people in New York City have a completely different view of the world than the rest of the United States, and they're the 1%. So what does that mean? I mean, they should be outvoted 99-1, you know. I don't want to be too harsh, good, because there's some wonderful people that live in New York City, too. But the people in New York think that they rule the world, and they don't. They benefit from the rest of us, and they're kind of at the middle. They skim off the top, the cream. And I'm not talking religious. I'm just talking about culturally and economically. But that also bears with it some responsibility. And part of the responsibility is giving respect for the rest of the country. And this is what I'm greatly disappointed in, certainly the last couple years. I see more and more in the media and the movies and other places, and it's not right. Eventually it's going to come back to them. I mean, they'll lose. The media will go elsewhere. Finances and economics go elsewhere because you just can't attacking your fellow citizens in this way.
Well, you know, we seem as a people to be perplexed as to why things go bad. Sort of like even in Lutheran Church, sometimes when churches decline in membership, we seem to sit there and navel gaze and wonder, how can such things happen?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, one of the other pastors who comes on this program one day made the comment that Americans are essentially Calvinist by osmosis, that the overwhelming number of founders had a Calvinist orientation. So you get a lot of this language that talks about one nation under God, or God shed his grace on thee. the almost, you know, language that sounds like the United States is some type of a chosen nation. And I'm wondering if you think that maybe, you know, this whole covenant theology thing, that if we do the right thing by God, God will do the right thing by us, is kind of a dangerous way of associating church and state.
Well, that has been the American way of looking at things, and there are problems with that. So, for example, in public schools, it used to be that they would regularly have prayers. They don't anymore. They would have pledge allegiance to the Christian flag, I believe. I think that used to be. It wasn't just the Pledge of Allegiance to the United States.
I'll tell you, in University City, where I went to kindergarten as a kid, we did do that.
Yeah, I seem to remember that in kindergarten, too. So, yeah. And that was back in the early 60s. So,
Very early 60s.
Yeah, very early 60s for both of us. there is an interesting book that I've read by Oxford University Press, and it talks about the myth of American religious freedom by David Sehat, S-E-H-A-T. Now, I don't think he's really sympathetic to religions, or at least established religions, like churches. But his argument is that before 1940, there wasn't a whole lot of religious freedom in the United States because the states were allowed by the U.S. Constitution to pretty much impose at least a general religious culture within their sphere. And after 1940, I believe it was an amendment to the Constitution that required whatever happened culturally at the federal level had to be done at the state. After that, the states couldn't do it. So, for example, the judge in what was Alabama wanted, there was a whole flap about the Ten Commandments in the courthouse. That couldn't be questioned back before 1940, but since 1940, we've gone more secular. But the way I see it is not so much more secular, and I probably have a lot of Christians that disagree with me on this.
Hmm.
But I believe that you need to respect all the religions that are here, and so that for example, a Hindu, when he sees the Ten Commandments, he says that's not. Those aren't the commandments that I follow. I have another code of law, another morality. And so does the judge represent me or not? The judge is supposed to be impartial. And so
right.
If I go into the courtroom and I see the Ten Commandments, that means the judge is going to rule in favor of the Jew or the Christian and not in favor of me. And so I can understand that. I can understand why people opposed, those who are not Christian, to Christian symbols in public places, such as courtrooms or public property or public schools. So I'm probably a stronger separationist, and this probably comes from my Lutheran background and Lutheran teaching than a lot of other people. But you're right that the standard way, the standard default setting for the United States has been kind of a happy going relationship between the Christian God and America, and that necessarily that really wasn't the intent of the founders, but that was something they worked against. Both Madison and Jefferson were not entirely able to overcome, but they did put it into law in the Constitution and the amendment, the First Amendment, and therefore it has continued to manifest their will and their ideas.
You know, we like to think that this idea of a separation of church and state goes back to this letter penned by Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists and how that has sort of been changed and manipulated over the past couple of centuries. But really, this division between church and state really goes back to Luther and the Two Kingdoms doctrine, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. And we see the first working out of the idea of two different kingdoms that actually is medieval. But the idea that that the church or officers of the church should not have specifically secular duties. That is Luther. And so they are trying at the time of that Reformation to separate where they can church duties or rights or responsibilities from those that are of the state. And they don't do it perfectly, but that's the basic theory. So it does go back to Luther, and therefore the American government and its situation with the express separation of church and state is most closely related, at least ideologically, to the Lutheran Reformation and not to the Calvinist or Reformed Reformation, and certainly not to the Roman Catholic idea.
So how does that inform, and we can get more into this after the break, we've got about 4 minutes before we have to, but I think you've got a good opportunity here to set this up. Two things. How does that, number one, inform how we, not just as Lutherans, but how we should be having discourse with other Christians about the role that we serve as, well, in our vocation as citizen, but also when it comes to, you know, how far do you hold fealty to the state? I mean, what are you first? Are you an American first? Are you a Christian first? How do you order your understanding of the left and the right?
Well, I root for the Green Bay Packers. Does that make a difference?
Well, if you would have said Cubs, that would have been the envy.
Sorry. But, yeah, because I know this is a St. Louis station, so I have to root for the Cardinals.
Well, that's okay. We don't have a football team in St. Louis, so don't worry about it.
Oh, okay. Well, so when it comes to football...
Everybody's going, the Rams! The...
Yes,
no,
the Rams.
No. Let's see if they can win a game this year. Then we'll talk about football.
You know, so when it comes to football, I root for one team. And when it comes to baseball, I root for the other. So it's kind of... I mean, we do that in life a lot. So, you know, I'm an American of... And I'm not ashamed of that in any way. I'm proud of what America has accomplished. My ancestry as Americans goes back to 1680, so at least on one side of the family. So there's a lot of us in the Missouri Synod that are like that. We're not just recent immigrants. But on the other hand, when it comes to religion, I'm a Lutheran, and I'm unashamed of that too, and I don't see... any conflict about that. You know, some people may see conflict, but there really isn't. And as I said, there's greater harmony between the Lutheran understanding of government and the issue of church and state and the American idea than there is with any other religion, at least in my experience and being able to divine these things.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Marty, let's see if we can get a quick call in from Jan before we have to go to the break. Jan, good morning. Thanks for the call.
Good morning, Roland. Good morning, Pastor. Briefly, are we assuming that we are more of an ecclesiocracy? And the other thing is, if we are, in fact, an ecclesiocracy, should we strive to be a theocracy? And I'm looking at 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 3, and Joshua 5, verses 13 through 15.
Well, I don't know the differences that you're making between the two. I don't believe that the United States, it's expressly designed to be not a theocracy or an ecclesiocracy. It has no particular connection to any particular religion or church body. And this gets to the issue of what is the term that they use, civil religion. The politicians can affirm the role of religion, and they usually do, because there are side benefits of religion for the state, for the culture, for society, for families, and everything else. For most religions, that's the case. So in that respect, that part of civil religion, or perhaps the idea of, and this I have less appreciation for, is the notion of providence, that the God is leading the country in a specific way and that we are like the light on the hill for the rest of the world. That's another way that politicians have kind of fused religion with the United States. But there's no doubt in my mind that most religion is of benefit to the country because it provides a moral grounding for the majority of the people that wouldn't come any other way. And the leaders of the country want a moral and obedient citizenry. And this is why Constantine brought the Christian church into the empire and why leaders since have always seen religion as a good thing.
A little bit of special music for our honored guest today, the Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan from Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Jan, thanks for the call. We'll continue the discussion on the other side of the break. You can join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Don't forget the email, kfuo@kfuo.org. We've got a few short announcements.
One of the core values of Concordia Seminary is faithfulness. Faithfulness to the Bible and the confessions of our church. Many people in America no longer believe that there is absolute truth. They say, you have your opinion, I have mine. All roads lead to heaven. But God has revealed truth. And we teach so that Concordia Seminary graduates will find winsome ways to present the truth.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
I find it interesting when man discovers big revelations through research that God long ago revealed to us in the Bible. The latest is parents who have lots of children live longer. An Australian study found women with six or more children are 40% less likely to die than women who had none. This increased with each child, and it's also true for dads. I'm so using this to get more grandkids. It probably pained these academic types to admit large families are good for you. But one researcher was quick to say, even so, you shouldn't have lots of kids because it's not good for the environment. There always seems to be room for political correctness. God told us in His Word, children are a blessing. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full. I say, amen.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Because we were unable to get to all the emails during our hour of ruminations, and because we were unable to finish the subject of prayer, the next broadcast will touch on both of those areas. Also, because it is an open mic Friday, we'll be happy to take your calls on any theological subject which is on your mind. 1 o'clock, Monday through Friday.
On KFUO Radio.
Hi, this is Joni Harwell. Have you ever considered becoming a KFUO Day sponsor? It's a great way to honor your loved one's birthday, confirmation, wedding anniversary, or any special event while supporting the worldwide gospel outreach of KFUO. A day sponsorship can be paid in monthly, quarterly payments, or all at one time. Would you please prayerfully consider becoming a KFUO Day sponsor? Just call me or Mary Schmidt at 1-800-844-0524. We can help you select that special day.
How would you like to enhance your legacy to your family and continue your legacy supporting God's mission through KFUO with a planned gift? A planned gift will enable you to increase your annual income, eliminate capital gains tax on assets, and receive a significant tax deduction. You can even list KFUO as a designated beneficiary of your life insurance policy or IRA. Call today, ask for Joni, and explore all the benefits of planned giving to KFUO.
The pastor of America's largest church has spent this week in the nation's capital preparing for a Saturday night event at the Washington Nationals ballpark.
We call it America's Night of Hope. It's 2.5 hours of music and inspiration and just going to try to lift people's spirits and let them know that there are good days up ahead.
More than 40,000 people have bought tickets to hear Joel Osteen. The pastor of Houston's Lakewood Church also has brought volunteers to help at facilities like the Capitol Hill Crisis Pregnancy Center.
If we can come along to say, hey, you know what? You can make it. It's not a surprise to God. And don't become a victim. Become a victor. Have a different mentality. I'm going to overcome this. And I think that's what helps us to move forward.
The center's director, Janet Durig, says when Osteen's people called the inner city ministry, she said,
is this a joke or are you really from Lakewood? You're talking about Joel Osteen's Lakewood. And the woman said, yes, I am. And I went, well, that's wonderful.
Osteen also has delivered opening prayers this week in the U.S. House and Senate. I'm Steve Coleman.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Ask the Pastor Hour of the Bible Study here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. Having a little bit of a discussion with our guest, the Reverend Dr. Martin Noland, about the relationship between church and state, the two kingdoms, left and right, as well as vocation as citizen in this state of ours. Marty, if you're ready, we've got some other callers that are lined up.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Art, good morning. You're up next with Dr. Noland. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, I'd like to ask the pastor whether or not he thinks maybe we should have internationally at the Hague Court for international conventions and thoughts, a crime against peace on the part of these international globalists, these politicians? And secondly, can a Christian be a patriot? As a Korean War veteran, and my friends and neighbors drafted me, they selected me to go over and represent them, and then they changed course, and then they said, you are now a member of the international peacekeeping. I can tell you why you see in the culture in New York City. Do you know the New York City employees' pension funds are tied to the economic and financial viability of the Middle East? My mother, back at the beginning of World War One, when they had the old phone on the walls, the ones that you rang, one, two, or three rings, the items of concern on that day was the boy down the road was killed. He was a member of the American Expeditionary Forces over there in Europe. The second was the Middle East, specifically Iran and Iraq. And third, she said the sun was a bright red, and that stuck with her all the time. Now, I had, my mother grew up in central Illinois, spoke and wrote with precision and definition with respect to her verbiage and wordage. When my father's brother came over, she said, he told her, you do better with the German language than we do over there. He went back to World War II, but every time he sat down, he gave a blessing. Feed thy children, God most holy, comfort sinners, poor and lowly. Hold this bread of life from heaven, bless this food thou here hast given. All the gifts thou here hast given. Well, in other words, he said, in other words, till at last in heaven we enjoy the bread of life with you. Is in so much words, I can't remember it all. But you know, we have these here international globalists that come on and they cloud the free media, the opportunity to express their, we got to be policemen of the world. They want to have the rule of law. But then the rule of law comes down to judges that are selected for neo-colonialistic ideas. They talk about minority rights.
Well, Art, what we're going to do, I mean, that's a plateful that you've given us there. Thank you for the phone call, Art. Marty, let's deal with these two primary questions. Should there be such a thing as a crime against peace, an international violation of law? And can you be a Christian patriot?
Yeah, those are excellent questions, and they do go into the area of church and state too. The first question is really goes back to the discussions after the Reformation. The Protestants, for a while, of course, were fighting the Roman Catholic Church. That resulted in the 30 Years' War, and during and after the 30 Years' War, the Europeans were. They said, well, if we keep doing this, you know, fighting each other for religious reasons, there won't be anything left. There are, in certain places of Germany, there wasn't anything left. So at that time in the 17th century, there were a number of thinkers, not just university professors, that were trying to figure this out and saying, how can a state or a country decide whether it needs to go to war? I mean, that's putting it bluntly, but how can it decide whether certain types of aggression, that is perhaps the kidnapping of some of its citizens on high seas, or the taking over of some of its properties, or whatever, how can it decide whether that's the right thing to do? Because if Christians just simply lay down their arms, well, then the Mongols will run over Russia, or the Islamic people will run over Spain and France, and pretty soon, you know, the people that are happy to use guns to kill everybody, they'll be in charge. You know, so this whole notion of a crime against peace, that began to be discussed, And the man that became most famous for his writing on it was a guy named Hugo Grotius, who was Dutch. And he was initially dealing with the issues of, I believe it was the Spanish and the Dutch were fighting over colonies in Indonesia. And they were Christians, of course, on both sides. So the question is, when would it be right for, after a certain amount of aggression, for the Dutch to go after the Spanish? And so he wrote a very important treatise that's still referred to today by people that deal with international law and international jurisprudence. And it is it follows Reformation principles. You know, being Dutch, he would had been reformed in outlook, but I think most of it would be stuff that the Lutherans could agree to. So this was the basis of international law, and the final manifestation of these ideas is the United Nations, and as he noted, the International Court in The Hague, where when there are international, that is, offenses between nations, that there is a place to which they can try to bring about some sort of settlement instead of going to war. Or when an important role the United Nations plays is that when the countries begin to be exhausted in war and they say, okay, we want to head toward peace, the United Nations help them work toward peace and then make sure that whatever the agreements of the peace treaties are, that they actually enforce them. Those are called peacekeeping missions. And I think what this gentleman, Art, referred to was in Korea, after the some of the initial work, after the peace, peacekeepers, quote, were sent in into South Korea to make sure that North Korea, you know, it's the same North Korea that's there today.
That's right.
You know, rattling sword that's been doing that for 60, 70 years. It's that it keeps to what it promised. So I think that's a good thing. It has reduced the amount of conflict around the world, even though the nations are more heavily armed in terms of the damage they can do with weapons. Yet the amount of damage that they've actually done, except for the major world wars, is less. So I think these are good things. They're positive outcomes of the 20th century and things we could say, well, there was actually some social political progress in the 20th century. The second question is, can a Christian be a patriot? And I would say yes. The Lutheran understanding is that God works through the church and God works through the state, the two governing agencies, and he gives certain responsibilities to the prince or the ruler or the president on the one side, that's the left-hand kingdom, and he gives other responsibilities to the church through its pastors on the other. And so you're expected as a Christian to have certain loyalties, both to the church and to the state in which you live. Does that mean you have absolute loyalty when either the church or the state goes wrong? No, you don't. And that was the purpose of the Reformation. The Reformation said the church is wrong. It's dang wrong. You know, it's been taken yes. over by the devil. You got to look at all those woodcuts that Luther helped. He stimulated these ideas that the devil is arm in arm with the Antichrist and all horrible things in the church. And so you have to oppose the church then if it's wrong. You don't do so just on a basis of opinion or because you don't like what they're doing. But if it's clear that they're forcing people to do things that are contrary to God's will, and that's the will that's revealed in Scripture, then you have to say, no, I can't agree to that. I disagree, and I just, and it's the same thing with the state. You obey it, you obey the laws, even when you don't agree with it. But if the government forces you to do something that you know is wrong, let's say, the government forces you to kill an innocent Jewish person in Germany in the 1940s, and you as a soldier say, I know this is wrong, this person's innocent. And then you don't do it, well, you might accept the consequences. So you're loyal to the state, but you're not absolutely loyal to the state when it commands people to do things that are contrary to God's law.
Well, you've sparked a curiosity in my mind now, Marty. When you mention, you know, crimes against humanity that came out of World War II, at the Nuremberg trials, the argument was made, well, we were just following orders. We were observing the morality standards of our state. And the prosecution said, no, there's a higher morality, sort of the natural law appeal, this law written on the heart that we know we're not supposed to kill, we're not supposed to steal, we're not supposed to do these things. But today, that whole idea of natural law is no longer theistic in its orientation. It's anthropomorphic. It's man-centered. It's the morality we come to a consensus to form this thing called natural law. And again, this is again where the state, in this case the broader state, the nations together in the form of a court at Nuremberg, comes into contact with theology. But if we divorce God from the process, to what common standard of morality do we appeal when you talk about things like crimes against peace? Who defines what peace is? Who defines what a crime is?
Well, in the basic outlines of morality, there's a whole lot of agreement. It's when you get to the finer points where there's a lot of disagreement. So things like the United Nations, things like the what I was talking about, Hugo Grotius, his doctrine about what is a just war. He's not doing it. He uses the Christian scriptures as an example, but he doesn't use it as the main argument.
Right.
In the areas of you say the broader outlines, the basic issues of morality, these are very clear. You don't kill an innocent person. There's no justification for that. That's the reason the Nuremberg trials were able to be able to accomplish what they did. It's a basic law that there's no disagreement on that. There's no culture or religion that would disagree with that.
Yeah, but see, we changed the definition of innocent. Look at abortion. You and I would say that the child in the womb is innocent life. We should not kill it. They changed the definition of what life. It's not life. It's just a clump of cells. It has no self-determination. It's a choice.
Right. I understand that. But that's a more difficult decision to make because, for example, the Roman pagans at the time of Christ regularly aborted, and they considered that an okay thing to do. They didn't have any moral qualms about it. The Christians and the Jews did not abort, and when the Christians took over the Roman Empire, basically, eventually. That's Constantinople, that's that.
That's right. That's why we play it.
That's how you play it. It's all about church and state, right?
Yeah.
When they took that over, then abortion went away, and by the time of the Code of Justinian, it was outlawed. And it was done so on a Christian basis, of a Christian understanding what a human being is. In the Roman law, all the rights inhered with the father of the family. It was called the pater potestas, which is literally the power of the father. So if a father felt that one of his sons was going to be a detriment to the family, he could put him to death. That would certainly get the young man to pay attention to what his dad was saying.
I would have cut the grass when I was told to, yeah.
Exactly. And so then if the father had the power to do this, the father also had the power to commit an abortion. That was their understanding of who has these rights and on what basis are they doing. That was the pagan Roman understanding. The Christian understanding is more based on a theoretical understanding of what a human being is, and that a human being is created by God. That's a fundamental difference. See, the Roman idea was more of a practical thing. We have a bunch of families, and the fathers are the head, and how are we going to get them to work together? Well, we better let the fathers have control over their sphere. And absolutely. In the Christian understanding, the pagan said, hey, the Christians are impinging on my right as a father over what I do. I want to abort that kid. And the Christian's saying, I can't do that. So you see, actually, the Christians were very intrusive in, at least from the standpoint of a pagan, a Roman father, on what he considered to be his rights. But the Christians did that because they understood that we're all under the fatherhood of God.
Right.
And that's what determines who is a human being and what sort of rights they have.
The same argument being made today, essentially.
Right, exactly.
Wow. Everything old is new again.
Exactly.
Yeah. When it comes to the understanding of vocation, now we talk about individuals as having a vocation as citizen, but does the church also have a vocation as citizen, as a member of the state?
Well, the primary purpose of the church is to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ and all that entails, and this is what churches, those that are properly constituted, it is what they do. It's what our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, it's what we do every Sunday and what we're involved with every week. We're not involved in the political process. Our churches do not hand out voting lists, at least none of I know do, none of the pastors I know do that. Maybe the biggest extent that we've ever done is that sometimes we let, if there's no other available fellowship hall, we let our gym or a fellowship hall be used for voting purposes. But that's it. Because we understand that the state has its own sphere and we want to stay out of that. But there is a role that the church plays. As I said before, we're in the business of producing good citizens that want to follow the law, that are obedient, and that want to be good citizens. And that means love your neighbor as yourself. Whether that neighbor is Jewish or Mormon or some crazy religion that came from California. I grew up in California, so I know about a lot of those.
Yeah.
That you respect that person and just as much as you would your fellow Lutheran. This is what we teach, and that is the role of the church. There is also one other area that churches can talk about these issues of church and state, not in a way of saying, oh, you got to vote for one party or you got to vote for one candidate, but to help educate our members in, first off, in what the U.S. government is all about and what is right or wrong, and helping people to make those decisions. Because as I said before at the beginning, people just, they haven't had a very good education in U.S. government or politics or the history of the United States. And so sometimes they need to be educated in these things as adults. And the church can do that.
Do you think Luther's explanation of the Fourth Commandment serves as a good rubric that everyone could follow?
No, it is. And those that are not familiar with the Fourth Commandment, in the large catechism, Luther talks about how we have many different fathers that are responsible for taking care of us. And we have our own father by blood. We have spiritual fathers, which are the pastors in our church. We have the fathers of the state, which are the rulers and the princes and the mayors of our towns. And because they take care of us, we also owe them loyalty and allegiance and obedience. And so the Fourth Commandment entails all those things. And that is Lutheran teaching.
When you look back across history, Marty, generally in the Christian era, who do you think has had the greater influence on the other, the state or the church?
Well, states come and go. And this is something Americans have to realize. Many political commentators, or more likely among the scholars that have some historical bent to them, say, this is more like an experiment in democracy. We don't know where it's going. The Germans had an experiment in democracy that lasted about 10 or 15 years called the Weimar Republic.
Right.
And only a few people today even know what that was. The gentleman that fought in the Korean War, he knows about the Weimar Republic and he knows why it fell. My dad fought in the Korean War and, he may have run into Art someplace along the line. And that, Tom Brokaw about the greatest generation, there's something to that. Those people understood. I mean, they made sacrifices in both wars, and they understood what government and politics and all this is all about. I don't know if I answered your question, though.
Well, I was wondering as a historian, if you look back over time, has the state generally held more sway over the church, or has the church held more sway over the state?
Over the long term, the churches or religions have had greater influence. I mean, the Christian religion is now going on 2,000 years. The Jewish religion is probably 3,500, or I mean, you could say 4,000 years old. The Confucian Buddhist religions, these things are ongoing. And it's not just a book, let's say the Dhammapada, a Buddha, but it's a whole culture that goes with it that has influenced many different countries. So the greater influence is probably the religious things. And this is why religious commentators in the mass media that demean religion, they don't know what they're doing. Because religion is an ongoing part of the human condition. Even if you're atheist, you have to acknowledge that. We're not going to suddenly, in a golden age, get rid of all religion. It deals with questions that people have that you can't answer any other way. It explains where we came from, both as individuals and as a human race. It explains where we're going, both as individuals and the human race, and it gives meaning for my life beyond just getting a job and having a beer with some friends.
Yeah, and generally, if you look at the Soviet era, the state's not very good at providing those things.
It did, and it failed to do that. And any atheist today has to look at the Russians. I mean, they did it right. I mean, they did it perfectly in terms of what's actually feasible, humanly speaking, and they failed because religion supplies things that the state or atheism cannot give.
And
you just have to acknowledge that.
Let's grab one more quick call. We've got about 2 minutes. David, thanks for the call.
You're talking about the Constitution. I just wanted to have you look at a website. I just did 10 weeks of constitutional study, and it's Hillsdale, Hillsdale.edu. /constitution, and I thought it was really good, and I thought they did a good job of connecting God with our Constitution.
Yeah.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah, matter of fact, when the National Rifle Association was in town a couple of weekends ago, I went down there, and they had a display, and actually talked with my daughter, talked to them a little bit about perhaps or maybe attending school there.
Yeah, it's a good college.
Yeah, it's in Michigan, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so, Marty, in the end here, we've got about a minute and a half or so before we have to let you go and get on with your weekend and other things that you have to get done. When it comes to politics and theology, should our theology be driving our politics, or should our politics be driving our theology?
Well, for Christians that are, let's say, Christians of the Bible, I mean, there are Christians that just want to, they just want somebody to marry and bury them. And I'm not going to talk about those folks. But people that want to live as children of God or as disciples of Jesus, the Bible and the Scriptures provides everything that you really need for orienting your life and the basic principles of that. And then if you want to have a particular political position, that's fine with me. But if you're that type of Christian, the Scriptures is going to produce that. And that's the Protestant view. And the fact is that within that, there can be great differences of opinion. You know, should there be wealth that's concentrated in a very small few number of people, and they get off free without any taxes? You know, is that a biblical view? I don't know. I don't think so. It's not necessarily a biblical view. It's so that there's going to be a wide variety of opinion about how do you run the state and the government and the local community, and there's a place for that. And there will be disagreements, and they'll be based on personal interests, where you sit in society, who your friends are. I understand that. And that's why the church needs to stay out of that, because the church is a place that's unified, and we want all people to be in it, whatever their position in society, whatever their color, race, or anything else.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Noland, our guest this morning on Ask the Pastor. Boy, this has been just wonderful. Thank you for your time, Marty.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. All the best to the good folks there at Trinity in Evansville.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, guys, that's it for this week's worth of Bible study and Ask the Pastor. We're back on Monday. Have a great time. Be safe. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Listen Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. Hi, this is Paul Clayton for Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky, inviting you to listen to Wrestling with the Basics Saturday mornings at 9:05 on AM 850 KFUO. We take a conversational and rather casual approach to Bible study on Wrestling with the Basics. And if you missed the program, remember you can catch it on demand on our website at www.kfuo.org. Wrestling with the Basics with Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky on AM 850 KFUO.
You used to nurse me.
Change my diapers.
Take care of me 24 hours a day.
Mom.
Dad.
I need you.
There's all these things I'm feeling that I never felt before.
I need to know about sex,
love,
values.
I need you to tell me what you think.
I need you to tell me where you stand.
Help me make the right choices.
Mom. Dad. Talk with me. You always say I'm still your little girl.
A message from the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services.
We are where you are. KFUO Radio, Clayton, St. Louis. KFUO HD, streaming live at KFUO.org.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. If you've got a student in college, or if you are one, this is for you. The House has just voted on those student loans and what to do about the interest rates. We go live to Capitol Hill and our Jerry Bodlander. Jerry?
Rita, the vote was mostly along party lines to keep the 3.4% student loan interest rates for another year. Even before the approval, the White House threatened a veto because Republicans structured the bill so the $6 billion cost would come from wiping out a preventive health care fund. Republicans say it's a slush fund and there's precedent for tapping it. Noted Democrats voted to go into it during the payroll tax cut debate. Democrats say the cost should be covered by eliminating oil and gas subsidies, and that's the way they're going to approach it when the measure goes to the Senate next month. Rita?
Thank you, Jerry. The Space Shuttle Enterprise, now a museum piece. It flew into New York, bolted onto the back of a 747 this morning. Our Warren Levinson was there.
Cheers and excited shouts of "there it is" went up from several hundred people gathered on the Battery Park shoreline as the Space Shuttle prototype Enterprise flew low and slow, piggybacked atop a 747 over the Statue of Liberty. The once-in-a-lifetime photo op delighted a horde of amateur photographers who waited for the sight on a chilly, windy April day. More than one spectator, taking note of the still painful 9/11 attacks, said it's nice to see something positive in the air down here. Warren Levinson, New York.
They evacuated an airport terminal in Minneapolis this morning and called the bomb squad, but it turned out to be a bag with a water filtration device. Two capped PVC pipes and several wires inside of it. The man who owned the bag said it's the second time his device has forced an airport evacuation. The president is signing an order aimed at protecting veterans and military families from being swindled by schools looking to get soldiers federal education money. This is AP Radio News.